Hey Todd, welcome to the show again.
Oh, it's great to see you again. Happy to be back.
Yeah, so it's been a while. I think it's mid-2022 is when we last talked. I think the conversation went really well. It covered a lot of interesting topics around big tech. And I thought, you know, I should have you again and, you know, talk some of the interesting things that are happening. I think the world has changed in a lot of ways, even though it's like not even 2 years, right?
So did we even talk about generative AI back then?
No, that was all crypto.
crazy.
It's crazy, right? How much of your coverage right now is AI?
I'd say it's the exception that it's not. Mm. It's amazing how much it's just taken over the world.
Yeah. Are 90% of your stories now on GeekWire AI or AI related?
You know, I would say it's more like two-thirds. This is my guess. There's still a lot of non-AI tech out there that's interesting. And frankly, it's kind of refreshing these days when you run into something that is not AI. That said, I mean, it's been energizing. This past 18 months has been, I think, the period, the most rapid change that I've experienced as a tech reporter, just covering the industry. It's been energizing, not only to cover, but also to use and see efficiencies in my own work. So a lot of interesting stuff to talk about.
Does AI live up to the hype it is generating in your mind?
You know, it depends on whose hype you listen to. For me personally, I'd say I'm a pretty heavy user. I can explain some of the things I do, which are, you know, nothing out of the ordinary, but I'd say I've become 20% more efficient in my job, just as a reporter and writer. And so I don't know, is that more or less than the hype?
I mean, 20% I think is pretty good, right? When you see something like crypto and suddenly you have, you know, when you have an actual tool that is impacting you on a day-to-day basis. How are you using, like, is it mostly about like rewriting or getting ideas to write? How are you using it?
Yeah, it's more in the process of synthesizing everything that I'm doing on my reporting into insights, things that remind me of what somebody said, the context in which they said it. I'm working on a big project right now, and I've done about 20 interviews for it. It's a pretty unusually large project for us. We're a little more into the daily and weekly cycle normally. And I've got all of the interviews that I've done through an auto transcript. And I use a tool called Otter AI. And it does the auto transcript. And then it also has a pretty powerful, in my experience at least, chat function that allows you to go back in. And the thing that I actually just got onto this week was they put me into a beta where you can take multiple conversations and put them into a channel and then focus the AI just on those. So I took all of the 20 or so interviews that I did, put it in there. And it's amazing the kinds of big picture insights you can get. Not that you wouldn't have those as a human, but to be able to basically get an outline of a story very quickly, based on your own work, is pretty powerful.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much touching everywhere where you write, for sure. Like, and that's pretty obvious as a use case for everyone. Yeah, even though like we are seeing some of the more hyped, you know, replacing developers or creating videos, I think, which are still, I think, about to happen, and things are happening so fast. But I think writing has been completely changed for a lot of people, and it sort of gave some equilibrium to everyone, you know, who wanted to write better. But have you thought about how would you still be unique if everyone has this access?
Yeah, and I've kind of gotten past that a little bit, just because I feel like, and you know, Microsoft uses the phrase drudgery a lot, in other words, eliminating drudgery. And so I almost hesitate to say that. That said, that has been my experience. The stuff that I'm using it for is the grunt work, the heavy lifting. And so far at least, and you know, certainly this can change, but so far at least, it's freed me up to do more creative thinking. And even at times, I'll give you an example. Like, I was just working on our podcast for tomorrow, to run on the GeekWire podcast tomorrow. And we always do a post to accompany the podcast. And I've done all of the work for the audio, done the interview, done the reporting on a lot of cases, and to have to then sit there and write a new version of all that work, it's much easier just to be able to have it outline something for you and then flesh that out. And so for me, being able to do that kind of stuff through AI with the AI tailwind is just, it's empowering.
For me, I think just the pure joy of experimenting with the new tools has been really fun.
For sure.
And like I started doing something called like 100 days of AI and sort of being intentionally spending like 2, 3 hours a day, and trying to document those learnings, experiments, and sort of generate more ideas and like forcing myself to be more actively engaged in understanding a little bit more deeper than what we see on a surface level, on a demo basis or in a particular tool gets viral. And it's been super, super interesting to see what are all, how rapidly things are improving. And if you just pour like because I've been storage mostly in my career the last couple of years. And if you see like what it would cost us to store 1 terabyte and how that graph went down in like last 10 years. And if you do the same thing for a GPU and what that would mean in terms of like how much technology that you can deploy and every usable imaginable case, if it comes true in 10 years, like it's so much more impactful, I would say, that we could see and provided we don't know how fast or slow these things go, but I could envision like once that happens, how impactful it's going to be. So in general, what I wanted to ask you about AI was like, how do you see the big tech ecosystem, playing with AI? Like, how do you see about Amazon, Microsoft? Because you've been covering this space for 10 years in the Seattle ecosystem so much more than probably anyone else. So what was your take in terms of like how Microsoft is approaching and Amazon is approaching and other companies in the space are approaching?
To me, in many ways, the story of 2023 was Microsoft's partnership with OpenAI. And obviously, that took some intriguing plot twists toward the fall with Sam Altman's ouster and re return and that whole thing. And so I think Microsoft has clearly established itself as a leader on the one hand. And the storyline that seemed to be trying to bubble up throughout the year was Amazon playing catch up. And I think now in one of the first few months here of 2024, I might be misreading it, but I think a lot of those questions about Amazon have started to go by the wayside. You've got them coming out not only with foundation models of their own and their Bedrock AI large language model as a service on AWS, but also some interesting applications. I got a chance to try out Rufus, which is their e-commerce assistant inside the mobile app that they're gradually rolling out to folks. And the Washington Post panned it a little, they thought a lot less of it than I did. I recognized that it was a beta and it's not going to be perfect. And I was more interested in the potential and what it says about what that kind of assistant could do. And for me, Rufus was. Like, for example, I was able to say, hey, I have this type of bike, a Raleigh Cadent 2, and I'm looking for a trainer, something to put it on to be able to ride it as a stationary bike. I didn't know what size tires it had. And I just said, like, what should I be thinking about? What trainers would work with it? And it said, oh, you have, 700C tires on that bike, and this is a good trainer for that. It's like, that was a magic moment for me. And so when you look at what Amazon's doing, I think it's uniquely positioned in that it's at every layer of the stack. And certainly Microsoft's doing some interesting AI applications, but I think Microsoft's superpower is that connection to GPT-4 and OpenAI, whereas Amazon is more broad in its partnerships, even though it's pretty heavy with Anthropic. I think Amazon is better positioned to be more broad-based.
Last time, I don't know if you remember, but we talked about Alexa not having product market fit. And I'm still sort of beating my drum about it. And I'm wondering why haven't they integrated Alexa with an LLM yet? I think that seems like quite obvious.
Well, they showed something last fall where you had to kind of enter a specific mode. And I actually don't think, and I might have just missed it, but I don't think it's actually been released publicly yet. It was
I
just a
didn't think it
demo.
is. Yeah, I
Yeah.
remember what you're talking about, and I don't think it
Yeah.
came out publicly.
Every time I interact with my Echo, with Alexa at home, I just kind of start shaking my head now. Things that in the past, would have been just very basic communications and I would have been okay with it, now seem, so rudimentary. And the lack of context, Alexa's not able to retain context as you go forward. I agree with you. I think every day or week that goes by that they aren't integrating that kind of natural language interaction in that voice assistant is a big miss for them. So that's certainly true.
Yeah, I wouldn't even be surprised if, like, OpenAI launches a Alexa-like device, right? I mean, it's so obvious that you can just put this thing in a voice format, and it sort of elevates the Alexa experience so much more.
It's funny you should say that, and I'm not trying to name drop. I went to the OpenAI Dev Day in San Francisco last year, and that was the question I asked Sam Altman. And it
Oh,
was kind of
really?
an outgrowth of some of the things we talked about, even though, generative AI wasn't a topic that we discussed last time. I asked him, would there potentially be a dedicated device? And then Ina Fried from Axios built on that. I can't remember exactly whose question sparked it, but he was clearly at the time open to the idea of either OpenAI or perhaps one of his other startups doing a dedicated device. I got to say, one of my favorite ChatGPT features, and frankly, the reason that I end up continuing to use ChatGPT, even though you've got Copilot and Claude and Otter for me, is the ability to go into the app and have
Voice.
that voice conversation. It's amazing. Like, so my favorite thing. Because as a journalist, if I'm reviewing or interviewing an author, a lot of times they'll send a PDF of the book as a review copy. And I'll do two things. One, I'll upload it to Speechify and I'll have Gwyneth Paltrow read it to me rather than having to read it myself. So it's kind of like a automated thing. They've licensed her voice in addition to, I think, Mr. Beast and Snoop Dogg and others, like celebrity voices. And her voice is fantastic in terms of just, it's just a great synthesized voice. But then the other thing I'll do is, I did this with Fei-Fei Li's book, the AI pioneer who came out with a book called The Worlds I See. I had read the book. I was gonna interview her. I read it really quickly. And then I it was about a month later, I was gonna interview her. And I was like, I need just some recollection. So I uploaded the PDF. And I was driving around on errands and just saying, to ChatGPT, remind me about her, what she said about her parents and the dry cleaners, like that kind of stuff. And it's so good. And to me, that's where all this is headed. Sorry, I know I'm rambling here, but to me, these general purpose chatbots caught a lot of attention. Obviously, they're boiling the ocean with all this data that they have, and they're delivering the world to you in generative AI form as a replacement for a search engine. And I think that's what Satya Nadella was initially pitching it as when they released the Bing integration. But to me, the power comes when I can constrain that data to what really interests me, reduce the chances of hallucination, and just get these rich responses based on the information I've
Yeah.
provided to the LLM.
I think that has been like the biggest application. I think what people are calling it as RAGs. And even like with the 100 Days of AI series, I've like documented a couple of how to, create your own RAG, because my blog posts are more about like something a developer would use. RAG is, I think, has been a very interesting application. And also when Gemini was released with 1 million token size, I think that is also a new sort of a bigger change that might leverage again a lot more applications, because now if the model itself has 1 million token context, do you really need a RAG on top of it again, to limit it? So I think there's some interesting things happening. Another example, like similar to how you are using sort of audio and audio to text and text to audio, one of the things I do is I write a bi-weekly newsletter. It's sort of like, what's happening in big tech strategy sort of a thing. But you might have seen other creators do this. Like, for example, Scott Galloway has a newsletter which someone narrates him for him, and it gets converted into a podcast on his feed. So what I do is my because I can't afford someone actually doing it for me, I actually take every week my newsletter, and it is converted into audio format using OpenAI API, and it gets published on my podcast feed. So that gives me another podcast episode on my podcast feed. I was even level thinking that I should provide this as a website so that other, newsletter authors should, can do it. But I didn't get the time to actually go and do that. But maybe I should at some point.
Is it in your voice, like a voice clone of
It's
yourself?
not in my voice. That would be next step, but it's in one of the default voices in OpenAI. But it's very similar to if I hire an American, it would sound exactly same, right? For example, like Prof G has George Hahn, I think, right? So if I might want like an Indian accent, or if I want to hire an American accent person, narrating to reach more audience, I think this is the perfect way to do it.
Yeah, but listeners to your podcast would want to hear it in your voice. I think, you've got a distinctive voice and
Sure, yeah, but
approach.
that's probably the next step I should experiment with. But that would be cool.
Can I ask you one other thing?
Sure, yeah, good.
Sometimes this has happened so fast that sometimes I just find myself wondering, like, does this thing exist? Like various different things. So
No.
one thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately along these lines is I would love to go to a service where all I do, if I'm a content owner, like geekwire.com, is put my URL in and I pay for this. It creates a large language model based on my full site map. So for GeekWire, for example, like articles going back to 2011, and talking about context windows, obviously that's not going to work even with the Gemini size. But does that exist where you could just go put in a URL and say, create an LLM
I
for this
haven't
domain?
seen it. It would be mostly similar to RAG, sort of like an application. I've seen chat with your data application, so where you have to download it into a PDF and upload it, but I haven't seen a specific website being plugged in. For my idea for like the podcast that I wanted to talk is because the difficulty is the API is pretty easy to use. The problem is not most people who run newsletters don't know how to use, and they don't want to deal with every week going there. So all the product should be is you give them an RSS feed. They take their newsletter RSS feed, and they also give their podcast RSS feed. Every week they publish, it translates and goes there. That solves the use case problem for the newsletter writer. And I think you're also
Interesting.
sort of pointing similar. Like I just want to put my website, my content, my blogs. And if I have to extend the idea, I'll extend it to like it's not just my website, but my website, my podcast, my YouTube appearances, my all the data that I exist on the internet that I care about that I've created, and put it and then sort of chat with it. I think we are getting there though, and I think it's very possible. I don't think why it doesn't exist, but it's a very real application that you could create.
Yeah, and then the questions that we debate around here when I bring things like this up are, would something like that be an internal tool? The answer to that is definitely yes. But would it also be an external product? In other words, would customers, users find value in a chatbot that they could use to query our domain? And that to me is a more of an unanswered question.
Yeah, I think it might make sense on a thing like, for example, in companies, what we do see is support, right? What essentially, how are people really optimizing support using AI is basically taking all the data dump that you've created over the years for support engineers, and you sort of do a fine tuning of the LLM based on that data, right? And then it's sort of what you're saying about your data, but the data we are querying here is different. And then you create a chatbot and provide it to the customers. And if that fails, now you transfer it to the customer engineer instead of directly going into the customer engineer. So the usual chatbot that exists, which was robotic and streamlined and had it was rule-based, right, primarily, that now becomes much more elevated. And I think we've seen example of, I forgot the company, which it's I think in Klarna, which had like, fired 80% of its support staff because of this particular reason. And I think it's a really powerful example. I do this in my day job because I have a particular set of documents I go keep going back to, and I personally am focused on. And I know that it exists somewhere, but I forgot the answer. So instead of going through all those documents and trying to figure out, what I did is I fed all those documents that I care into a fine-tuned LLM on my local machine, and I can just ask a Python query, and if it has, it tells me it has something, and it will tell me where it is. So it's very simple, but you can see this being rolled out, and I think this is part of the logic for like Copilot for security and Copilot for Word. I think part of this logic exists in these products now. I haven't fully experimented with this Copilot for security and other Copilots, but I would assume that that's part of the logic.
Yeah, that's great. I did not mean to sidetrack you from your questions, but
No
that's actually
worries.
really helpful to me, so thank you.
What do you think about the whole debate of, data versus, I think New York Times is suing OpenAI, right?
And Microsoft,
And
yeah.
Microsoft. And I think some of the artists, sorry, there's a Books 3 library, which so the authors whose books are part of that library are also suing OpenAI. And I think they mentioned Hugging Face because that repository was hosted on Hugging Face. But I think Hugging Face said that, hey, that repository was never hosted here. There was a script which could download the repository, but that was hosted. But that's a nuance there. But what do you think about, what's happening with, free data versus, protected data, like the whole debate?
I think that there's got to be some sort of standard that emerges either from the litigation that you mentioned or from some sort of legislation. I think neither of those tools is ideal. Certainly, legislation is going to be hard to come by these days, at the national level at least. I feel like I read very closely the New York Times lawsuit. It's been a month and a half or so, but the thing that struck me at the time was the fact that they were able to prompt ChatGPT in such a way that it reproduced articles verbatim. And I think that's where the rubber is going to meet the road on that lawsuit. I think that makes it clear that not only are they using that repository of data to train the LLM, but it's hard to argue against that being a copyright violation. I mean, that's very clear, and that reproducing it in that form at that length must violate copyright law. It's got to go beyond fair use. And so I think those two things are going to be interesting, the training and then the reproduction. And I think the reproduction is going to be just flatly stated. And do you remember last year when, and I realize this gets into your employer, but remember last year when ChatGPT integrated Bing initially, the Bing live search into the plugin, not live search, but the Bing search into the plugin, and they took it down for a while. My understanding was that that was in part because people were able to get around paywalls. And it just feels like in all these ways, it's sort of the Wild West right now, and I'm kind of waiting for the sheriff to show up, and I just don't know who that sheriff is yet.
Yeah. Another thing I thought it would be interesting to ask you, because I think BigQuery was closely tracking, is layoffs in tech. I think, I mean, my take on it was we've overhired in tech during pandemic, assuming that the trends continue, then we sort of corrected. But my thinking always about tech businesses and how the companies operate is, they're actually well-run, efficient machines. when you compare with like the rest of the businesses. Like, you know, you take a Disney or, for example, any other sector and pick a bigger company. I always considered, you know, the bigger company, the big tech in general, as better run companies because they have better data, better tracking, you know,
Interesting.
adjustment towards, you know, trends, more data driven in general. But it feels like the recent continuous layoffs are more than that. And I would like to get your take on what you are thinking.
I think the macro was a few different things. You had this sort of follow the leader thing that happened in late 2022 and early 2023, where it felt like every company had to at least show Wall Street, if they were publicly traded, that they were, you know, making sacrifices. It felt a little like the Hunger Games, unfortunately, at the time. And, you know, following up on the, you know, 2022 and the huge raises and the retention battles, it was just this weird flip. So to your point, it felt like it felt like perhaps they overhired, and spent too much on headcount. And now it feels like it's more in response to genuine macroeconomic trends, where everybody, in terms of enterprise customers, is pulling back on their budgets, just being much more cautious. I had a great conversation yesterday with Smartsheet's CEO, Mark Mader. You know, that's a big company, $5 billion in market cap, about 3,000 employees. And there were a couple interesting points that came out of that. He explained that they're seeing AI juice demand for, you know, initial contracts, but what's sort of been pulled back is expansion by existing customers, adding seats. They're not doing that at quite the rate as they were before. So it's this weird dichotomy that he's seeing. But then on their employment, they've only increased their employment by, you know, 100 employees over the past year or so. And I'm sure there's lots of attrition and all that stuff and hiring. But and his point was he does not think they're going to have to hire at the pace they used to achieve the same level of productivity because of all the AI tools. And so you're already starting to see, I mean, is that AI taking jobs, or is that AI taking somebody's job and making it more efficient and making it so that a company doesn't have to create more jobs? It's really an interesting moment right now in all of these areas.
I mean, if AI makes 20% of your job better, that means for every five people, you could only now hire four people, right? So I think that sort of plays out at a company level for sure, if they're seeing productivity levels increase. Another probably like interesting thing that's happening right now is the TikTok ban or divestiture.
Yes, man. No, I've dabbled in TikTok, and my 13-year-old daughter ridicules me endlessly because I am more of a YouTube Shorts person. I don't, you know, the YouTube algorithm just sucks me in. But yeah, I'm interested in your take on this. I've been going back and forth with this well-known investor locally behind the scenes on like what's going to happen with this. And his take was that, yeah, I mean, this could very well happen. You know, it would be mechanically possible to get this thing off the app stores if it becomes law. It's just crazy. What do you think about it?
I think they're giving 6 months time to change the ownership. And I think there is some amount of context. This happened before in case of like Grindr, if you remember, that Grindr had to change ownership as well because sort of similar issues of data privacy, et cetera. And they realized that they have to change ownership, and it happened, and the app continued to stay operational in the US. So I think it will not get banned because I think too much of American interest exists for it to get banned. I think Jeff Yass owns, and I'm a little bit surprised that I've written about Jeff Yass like about 8 months back in my newsletter. And it's become right now popular that you know Jeff Bezos owns a significant amount of ownership in TikTok, and he has been funding super PACs to promote sort of, you know, reduce the narrative around TikTok banning. But I think it's too big of a thing to let TikTok operate in the way it operates today. And I think there are two parts of it. One is you have to obviously force divestiture to make sure that, you know, no foreign influence is actually controlling your audience, your citizens. The second part, I think, is sort of because, you know, if it is TikTok and because, you know, the narrative is so hyped up, I think the proper trade policy with China is not being the focus. I think it would be advantageous for US to get access to Chinese markets, right? More than, you know, banning or unbanning TikTok, if you have to think long term here. I think that narrative is the one which really needs to get driven. And you need to really have a policy there. Because, yeah, TikTok is just one company at the end of the day. You know, people say it's like $250 billion worth. I don't think it is. You know, some people even say it's a $1 trillion worth company. I don't think it is, because once Instagram and YouTube Shorts sort of get better at algorithms, it's sort of the network effects, you know, take over. Like, I think people will eventually end up on Instagram more than TikTok. And
Do you feel like the data privacy and the manipulation concerns that are expressed are legitimate from a technical perspective?
They are legitimate because you know that all manipulation is slow manipulation. It's not fast manipulation, right? It's not like one day I did an ad campaign and everyone changed their mind. It's always a slow manipulation. So I think if there was no TikTok, it would be Fox News, it would be MSNBC, where the ad dollars would be spent, and, you know, where, you know, the talking heads funded by different, you know, groups, a secret super PAC funding a PAC that funds, you know, someone who gives you a particular opinion on a different channel. I think that has been the MO on how these things operate, right? So I think it would change, but I think it's the scale is also different, right? I mean, the scale of a technology is different than, you know, putting 100 talking heads across different channels and, you know, getting the message out. I think it's definitely different. It is definitely a valid concern. I think it's more than data privacy. It's mostly narrative manipulation is what I would say. I'm not really that concerned about data privacy with TikTok, because, you know, what are the 16-year-olds' data is going to be so important for China? Like, what are they going to do with that, right? So it's
great.
Not
grilled cheese recipe, right?
Yeah, so there's no amount of, like, this I think everyone feels that their data privacy is so important. I don't think it is actually not that important, except for your bank accounts and, you know, your property accounts,
right? Yeah,
if I'm eating cheese on a particular day and, like, Amazon wants to know about it, like, feel free to right,
service the ad in your Prime Video. So you mentioned politics, obviously, is at play here, and the U.S. presidential election is interesting in two respects. Then, you know, if it's 6 months or probably more that they're going to give them, I would imagine, you know, those kinds of things end up getting stretched out. I mean, there was that whole thing that, you know, the Oracle, the data sovereignty and all that, which went on for several months. Anyway, what happens if there's an administration change? And then two, you're talking about this subtle long-term manipulation. Like, what happens in the meantime if this platform is able to be abused by different interests? It's what a crazy time.
Yeah. And I think it's also like America is generally open, right? Like, it's more capitalistic. It's more open to, you know, other outside countries investing in America. Everyone wants to invest in the US. So it's not in the nature for US as a policy to ban, and I don't think they are making this a ban. I think they are giving 6 months time. I think that's good enough time to change ownership, maybe not move data centers and everything tech per se, but change in ownership can be done in 6 months, right?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and so you're sort of seeing everyone's citing the precedent of social media as reason to really start paying more attention to AI now.
Yeah.
Look what happened here. Let's pay more attention here. And so here you have it, in some respects, coming home to roost in the form of TikTok. Yeah. It's, and yet you've got all these people who built businesses on it. And so what happens there? It's really a fascinating time.
But also, there's also this fact that there are people who build business on TikTok, but I've often observed that a successful TikTok creator is actually going to be a YouTube creator. I think TikTok is where like it's begins as a hobby. They find their product market fit on what type of content they make and what to sell, but they actually go immediately onto YouTube where they actually make real money because of how big YouTube actually is. So I don't think that even if you're making a lot of ad revenue from TikTok, it is number one, it's not organic, as organic as YouTube, because they had to create a separate fund to fund your creator salary, if you can call it. Right. So it's not as organic ecosystem as YouTube is. So TikTok, I always found that TikTok creators end up becoming YouTube creators, because like
That
TikTok
makes
is where you
sense.
got your first internship and then you figure out how to do the job and actually find the job on YouTube.
Did I lose you? Oh, I lost you there.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. What was it? It's a minor connection. That's weird. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think like TikTok is where people find the product market fit of what type of content they make, but eventually they realize that, oh, they have this bigger opportunity on YouTube.
Yeah.
Because like a real creator middle class, if at all we can call it, only exists on YouTube. Every other channel is sort of merges into YouTube. YouTube is where like people make real money. There are obviously like niche things like newsletter, and but the niche sort of becomes much more if like 10 people out of 100 can make money on YouTube. On newsletter, it will be two or one, right? The ratios are so staggeringly different. So overall, I would say like TikTok ban will not even affect businesses if it all happens. And because there are alternative products, right?
Yeah, from a broad perspective, I can only imagine that Microsoft and Facebook and Amazon, to some extent, are more than happy to see this playing out because the spotlight, at least for the moment, is not on them when it comes to the tech industry. And it's funny how it shifts,
Yeah.
it sort of depends on who's testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee or whatever in any given week.
Mean, I thought this was the same reason why Facebook changed its name to Meta, because
Right.
Mazak didn't want the attention. They just said, like, let's change this company's name and see if that helps.
Yes, exactly. So.
Another sort of topic I thought would be interesting to talk to you about is, what are you seeing with the back to office trends? I think there's sort of like mixed opinions. Some companies, requiring requiring employees to come. Some companies, lesser so. So what are you seeing, and where you ended up?
Yeah, I love this topic. I was out at a company called StatSig in the Bellevue area. It's run by a CEO named Vijay Raji. He was the head of Facebook's Seattle Engineering Center for many years before he started it. And I visited. I knew somebody who worked there, and I arranged to speak with Vijay. And I realized they didn't even mention this in advance, but I realized they were in the office 5 days a week. 5 days a week by default. And it was a novelty. It was such a novelty. And it was so crazy to me because, 4 years ago or whatever it is, 5 years ago, this would have been the norm. And it was extraordinary. So I wrote a story about it. I went on LinkedIn and I was like, anybody else actually going into the office 5 days a week? And I found two other companies, two other startups in the Seattle area that were doing it. And so, to me, though, that's an outlier, right? That's the exception that proves the rule, because it seems like the standard is either flexible and remote, or the Amazon model of, and to some extent, the Microsoft model of 3 days a week in the office. My sense of it from the outside is that Amazon is more stringent in tracking and making sure that people are in the office at least 3 days a week. I wonder. I was also just talking with a biotech investor in Spokane, a biotech leader, life sciences leader in Spokane, and that's on in Eastern Washington. And they've actually really benefited in that market from remote work. And her point was, hey, there's a risk that there could be a backlash. And if it gets to the point where we get back as a society to this norm of being centered around offices, that would be bad for markets like Spokane and other sort of mid-tier tech communities like that. It feels to me like we're settling into just a range of things with, somewhere in the middle being the 2 to 3 days a week. That's where I see it. I can just tell you based on my experience. So we just moved to a smaller office in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood, Geekwire. And we did that because our lease ran out. We had space that was built for a team that, was in the office at three times the size of the number of the people that we have in the office now in terms of participation. We have there are days when I'm the only person in the office, or my colleague John is the only person in the office out of our entire team. And I have to say, as somebody who grew up in a newsroom culture where I learned, I feel like half of what I know about how to go about reporting just from picking up the ambient knowledge, the just sort of contextual experience from those around me, just from listening to the reporters in the cube over the next cube over and how they did their jobs, the ones that were more experienced than I was at the time. And I feel like it's going to be a big gap, at least in our profession. I think I've already seen it with some younger reporters where they're doing their best, but they don't get the benefit of learning by osmosis from those around them. And at that level, it does not happen on Slack or Teams or anything else.
Also, I think if you have to like gain that knowledge, you have to be much more intentional about like setting up recurring meetings, and the other person should also be like intentional about like giving that knowledge, right? Because when you're sitting in a cubicle on the side and you're overhearing some of the knowledge, that you don't have to do additional effort. Like it takes a little bit more to be intentional and actually have to have a plan to do that.
And that is hard in a small organization.
Yeah.
You need some infrastructure. You need some people who are dedicated, at least in part, to making sure that type of thing happens. And that's what we run into. I mean, we're a small, scrappy organization. We're 13 years into it now, but we still sort of think of them the startup mentality. And for us, it's not really in our wheelhouse. So it's a challenge.
Did you get to try Apple's Vision Pro?
I have not tried it yet personally. I've talked to a bunch of people who have. I'm a huge fan of VR, and I have a Meta Quest 2. Yeah. And love to play ping pong in that. It's
Did you try
so.
their Ray-Ban glasses?
No, I have not. I have not. Have you tried the Vision Pro yet?
No, I was hoping you would try and
I'm
give me some
sorry. I
insights.
know my geek cred just went down a few notches, though.
Yeah.
Part of the issue for me on that is I'm a Android user, Windows PC user,
Yeah,
and
that's me too.
as with all things Apple, I mean, for better or worse, a big part of the benefit there is the integration with their existing devices, at least from what I've seen. And like I watched as many YouTube videos as I could that first week, and it feels like that virtual environment with the Mac and the ability to put the additional Vision Pro screens around it is a big part of the benefit.
Yeah, that's so there my theory was, because now Apple Vision Pro is sort of official and out there, and Meta is competing, like the original competitor here, right? So if you do a parallel that to the mobile era of Android versus iOS, Meta is not really competing with Apple, it's actually competing with Google. And we sort of hear the framing of Apple versus Meta in the news on a daily basis, but it's actually Meta is competing with Google, and it's actually eating market share from Google. It is Google's market that they're eating, and every year Google delays their launch of their own, Vision Pro or, a version of that device. Meta goes ahead and loses business. Google
Interesting.
loses business because the Apple religion is so strong that their fandom and is so strong, the people in Apple ecosystem will continue to use Apple Vision Pro. They'll wait for a cheaper product if this is too costly. They'll not use Meta's product or Google's product until that changes, right? Unless something really in the world changing happens on Android, the shift doesn't happen. That religion is too strong for a shift to happen right now.
Interesting. You know, I was there for the original HoloLens launch on the Redmond campus. Like when they came out and said, hey, we're doing this crazy thing. It's a headset. It was amazing. And I look back on that now, because for me, and again, maybe I'm just a weirdo, but I look at a lot of the applications on the Vision Pro and even on the Meta Quest. I really just want the virtual screens all around me. I want to be able to, like I'll tell you, I take a portable second monitor when I travel to a hotel. Like I would much rather take a headset, be able to put it on. And I don't think I would work like that every day, but in certain situations, the ability to have multiple virtual screens.
Yeah.
And I've tried the virtual desktop app on the Meta Quest 2, and it's kind of limited to what you actually have in the physical world.
Mm.
And I feel like, at least that's been my experience. And again, so much is out there, I might be missing something. But I look back on that HoloLens launch and I ask myself, like, wow, what if Microsoft had really focused on its core business, like Windows? Yes, Windows.
It's not too late. I think it's still this. The market is still out there to capture. I think the Android market is out there to capture it.
I think so. But if from Microsoft's perspective, there's a perception, at least, and based in part on some of the Business Insider coverage. Ashley Stewart did a great job just sort of diving into that last year. There's the perception, at least, that it's going away. I don't know. And I know Microsoft has been really vague about it, but I feel like if they're going to do something, they need to do something quickly, given everything that's happening with Vision Pro.
Yeah. I mean, they were sort of created the hype in the AR space, but it's interesting to see that not playing out long term. I think just like how Microsoft Office eventually jumped into everywhere, like being everywhere, right? You could probably see, I mean, I think Meta or some of these already have some Microsoft apps in there, but I don't know, like the Windows thing makes a lot of sense. I don't know if you remember the phone, Microsoft phone did integrate with Windows. That really interesting features, because we always decouple our operating system on mobile and desktop. That sort of created a different world. But if they were all connected, like we would all be carrying our phones as the only computer we would ever need. And we are just a bunch of monitors roaming around. Like that world never came true, because the operating system on your Windows or on your laptop and your mobile, you know, are different. And that's why we have these different ecosystems now.
I'm meaning to go back in and check out Phone Link, because for me, I went in when I was using Mac and iPhone. I loved to use Messages, Apple Messages, iMessage on my Mac. I'm big into texting on the computer. I don't want to have to always sit there and And so it's to your point on the ecosystems. Like as soon as I switched to Windows, I was like, well, I've got to go Android if I'm going to do that. Now, I know Phone Link, you know, there's different things that you can do to connect them inside Windows now, but the last time I tried it, it was a little wonky. So
yeah, even Samsung tried doing something like that, and it never fully worked. That's because you have to have a single operating system across and full control of hardware and software. I think that world never played out. I think for Apple, I think that is still because they control the whole thing. And that what works for them. I think we're almost up on our time, but you know, always have, you know, great chat with you. What are you listening to these days, and what are you consuming in general before we go?
Yeah. You know, I've been trying to walk more. I've been trying to get up off my butt and get out and walk more. So I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks, you know, either actual audiobooks or books that I created or that I, you know,
anything
uploaded. Uploaded. I last week I finished Kara Swisher's Burn Book, and it's a bit of a guilty pleasure kind of book for anybody in the tech industry. And yet there were lots of good nuggets, a little bit Silicon Valley focused for me. I would have preferred And even during her Seattle visit, she was very much talking about Facebook and not necessarily about Microsoft and Amazon to some extent, but just lots of good insights from her. And for me personally too, her journey through the media business from mainstream media to her own properties, like John and I have looked to what Walt and Kara did with All Things D and Recode. And so we've in our own, modest way been on a parallel path. And so we've always watched what they've done and learned from it. So that book was a good one to do. Yeah.
All right, Todd, always a great having to great having you on the show. So thanks for coming again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Happy to do it anytime.